Well, turning your Bibles, if you would, to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6, we're in verse 14 tonight. In our study of the believer's armor, we're examining some of the individual pieces of equipment, and the first three pieces are found here in verses 14 to 15. It's been a couple weeks, so I'd like to start back in verse 10 and read verses 10 to 15 just to get started. So Ephesians 6, 10 to 15. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness, and as shoes for your feet, having put on the readiness given by the gospel of peace. That's where we'll stop for tonight. So we are gearing up for battle, and the order from on high is stand firm, soldier. Stand firm. So we're putting on the necessary equipment, the belt, the body armor, the footwear. We've got to be properly outfitted before we are ready to leave the tent and head out to the battlefield. So we've already considered the belt of truth. I want to get into the second piece of equipment tonight, the breastplate of righteousness. Why do we need a breastplate of righteousness? Why do we need a breastplate at all? Well, short answer, because the enemy is so very ruthless. A ruthless enemy. The enemy hates the fact that we have been declared righteous by God. He hates righteousness and he hates the fact that we've been declared righteous. Declaration of righteousness from God upon our lives is justification. That's a big way of saying that God has declared us righteous. And notice that I didn't say he's declared us without sin. That is true. He has forgiven all of our sin in the cross, but he's gone further than just erasing our sin. If he just took away our sin in the cross, that would bring us back to the state of Adam in innocence. What he's done is further than that. He's declared us righteous, which means a fulfillment of all righteousness. So there's a negative aspect, taking away the sin. There's also a positive aspect in fulfilling all righteousness. Now, did we do this? No. We didn't. We committed all the sin. That's what we contributed. We contributed none of the righteousness. Christ has taken away our sin on the cross, and Christ has fulfilled all righteousness. So being found in him by faith, when we trust him, God declares us righteous. The devil hates that. He hates the fact that we are untouchable. He doesn't like that one bit. He hates the fact that now that we have been justified by God, Romans 5:1, hates the fact that we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. He liked it. He liked it when we were at war with God along with him. We were on his side. He considers us traitors, treacherous to his cause. So now that we're reconciled to God through faith in Jesus Christ, we now, because it's our nature, the nature that God gave us in the new birth, we pursue righteousness as a lifestyle, bearing God's image conforming to Christ. And that's essentially what putting on the breastplate of righteousness refers to. It refers to our daily pursuit, our constant pursuit of practical righteousness as a lifestyle, as a way of living. Our pursuit of righteousness is based on the fact, grounded in the reality, that we have already been declared righteous by God. So you need to understand, we are not trying to earn any position with God. We have declared by God, we are complete in the Beloved. We're complete in Christ. But that divine declaration of our right standing before God is justification. It is his declaration of righteousness in our lives. But that commences a pursuit of righteousness that is lifelong called sanctification. That will only end at the very end when we're either translated into heaven through death or when Christ returns to receive us to himself when we are glorified. So glorification. So it starts with justification, which is God's act, continues with sanctification, where we participate with God and the Spirit in growing in righteousness, practical outward righteousness. Glorification is when that process is complete instantly through death or instantly through the translation of ourselves to heaven by Christ. So the devil hates us for all of that. He just cannot stand it. Now, notice the breastplate is one of the pieces of the equipment from verse 11. It's part of the full armor, and it's a full armor of God. This is God's armor, okay? So like the other equipment, the breastplate of righteousness, this righteousness, it's not of us, even though we are pursuing it. It's not of us, it's of God. It's God who works within us both to will and to do according to his good pleasure. So this is a righteousness of God. Since this is God's righteousness, some are led to believe that we're talking about the gift of righteousness and justification. I just want to make clear this eternal protection that is justification, our right standing before God, that's not exactly what we're talking about here. Okay, we're talking about in verse 14, what Paul wrote here, he makes it clear that putting on the breastplate of righteousness is our responsibility. This is something that we do. This is a command to us. So this isn't about justification, God declaring us righteous. In fact, that's more what the helmet of salvation is about. Our head protected from the enemy's death blow. This piece of armor, this breastplate of righteousness, it's about holy living. So just like girding our minds with truth, just like the next one, putting on the gospel of peace on our feet, putting on the breastplate of righteousness is something we do. This is something we pursue. The participle here is actually, it's in the middle voice, so it's something we do to ourselves. And even the meaning of the word, the verb is enduo, getting dressed, putting on clothing, that's the word. All those good biblical counseling verses that tell us to put off and then put on is this word enduo. Same word that Paul uses right here. So again, the devil hates God. The devil hates God's righteousness. He hates the fact that we've been covered in the righteousness of Jesus Christ. Hates the fact that we pursue conformity to righteousness to the righteousness of Christ as a reality of the new birth. Can't stand that. He doesn't like the fact that now we don't love sin like he does, that we love righteousness instead, that we pursue it. The devil hates all that, so he opposes us. He hopes that we'll falter. He hopes that we will fall. He hopes that we'll lose interest in pursuing any conformity to Jesus Christ in righteousness. Our Puritan friend, William Grinnell, I love what he says here. He asks this question, what is it that makes the devil and his instruments take arms and breathe slaughter against Christians? It is their godliness. The devil hath an implacable malice against Christ. He hates, as I may so say, every letter of his name. That godliness which is learned of Christ and derived from him, the devil opposeth unto death. Christian blood is sweet to his tooth, but the blood of the Christian's godliness is far sweeter. He had rather, if he could, kill that than them, rather draw the Christian from his godliness than butcher him for it. The devil accounts that the complete victory, when he can despoil them of their armor and bribe them from their steadfastness in their holy profession. He'd rather see saints defiled with unrighteousness and sin than defiled with their blood and gore. Persecution, he hath learned, doth but mow the church, mow meaning in the sense of pruning it and strengthening it, which afterward comes up the thicker for it. It is unholiness that ruins it. End quote. Folks, this is exactly what I see among so many in the professing Christian church today. So many that are ruined and compromised and defiled, not with the gore of their blood as martyrs, but with the gore of their sin. so many defiled with sin and unrighteousness. I'm sad to say there are many churches today, even evangelical churches professing, that are even resurrecting old, ancient heresies to justify their own turning away from the pursuit of righteousness. Maybe you could jot this down. Look up Albert Mohler. Not that he did this. Albert Mohler, he wrote an article called Getting Unhitched from the Old Testament? Andy Stanley aims at heresy. That's the name of the article. Getting Unhitched from the Old Testament? Andy Stanley aims at heresy. He talks about Andy Stanley, a very famous, well-known pastor here in our country in Atlanta, who's resurrecting the heresy of Marcion, who taught a radical discontinuity of the Old and New Testaments, concept of God. Irenaeus said Marcion himself divides God in two, saying that one is good, the other judicial, and in so doing takes God away from both. That's what Andy Stanley is aiming at right now, teaching his church, thousands of people under his influence, and many, many more by extension through the internet and books and all the rest. He's not alone. Many people are trying to divide God and say, let's abandon the Old Testament, abandon scriptural forms and patterns, and let's put forth this New Testament ethic of love. Of course, not biblically defined love, but love is defined by whoever the teacher is. Whatever breastplate that many modern evangelicals are wearing, if any, many of them, is so battered, so corroded, so broken that it bears little resemblance to the divine armor that is cut from the pattern and conforms to divine righteousness. So for those whose body armor has not been well maintained, the vital organs are all open and exposed to the enemy. They're vulnerable and defenseless against his next attack. So, beloved, let's make sure that's not us. Let's make sure that's not us. We want to make sure that we're protected. We want to make sure that we're covered by righteousness. Not the righteousness of justification. Oh, yes, we need to make sure that if we're not covered by justification of God, that, I mean, that's the first step right there. But the practical pursuit of righteousness and sanctification. We want to make sure that we're covered. We want to be concerned about our moral and ethical conduct. So as we proceed tonight and next week, what I'm going to do this evening is what, you know, we could call it an armorer's briefing. Just kind of walk through the armor. First, we need to understand the figure. What is Paul referring to what's in his mind when he wrote about this breastplate of righteousness? We'll talk about the different kinds of body armor that were available in Paul's day, so you can see for each kind of armor the advantages, the disadvantages, see the different levels of protection that they provided. This is just going to be a study, an exercise, an observation tonight, especially. Second thing, we want to make sure that we understand the kind of armor that God has provided for us. That means we need to learn the meaning of the figure, how it relates to the Christian's righteousness. So that's a bit of interpretation. So first observation, then interpretation. And then third, we need to make this practical. We need to know how to put on the breastplate that God provided for us, how to maintain it, the implications of not maintaining it, and all the rest. So this is a bit of application. So observation, interpretation, application. Just to set your expectations, we're not going to get to all that this evening. We'll observe tonight and then interpret and apply next week. So if you're here tonight, make sure you come next week. Otherwise, you're just going to get a bunch of information. All right? So if you want to make this practical, come next week as well. So let me ask you a question. We got microphones. Got one over here. And you've got your running shoes on. Good. And Jordan over here. All right. Why did a soldier wear a breastplate? Why did he wear a breastplate? We got Jack right at the back there. What was the purpose of it? What's the purpose of the armor?
I mean, in the medieval time, the breastplate was what protected from the shoulders to about the waist. And it was just, it was normally made of a chain mail and then a big sheet of metal over it.
Why put that on, though?
I mean, despite the heaviness, it protects blows from a sword or an arrow. It's pretty much...
And swords and arrows are bad.
Yeah, it's pretty much impenetrable from anything that could be kill you.
That's right. It's exactly right. Thank you, Jack. Anybody want to add to Jack? We got one right ahead of you there. And if I'm not mistaken, your name is also Jack. Jake. Sorry, Jake.
Yeah. So the breastplate essentially protects most of the vitals of the body, protecting the heart, the lungs, the stomach, anything that could be struck and really do a major mortal wound to the body.
So protects the breastplate would protect the vital areas from mortal wounds against essential pieces of our body, lungs, heart, those kinds of things, right? You need those. They're not the heart, the lungs, they're not what is going to strike the blows, right? That's our arms. But you take away the heart and the lungs, we're not striking anything, right? We're dropping to the ground. Good. So mortal blows. Anybody else want to add to that? That's pretty much sums it up. So, yeah, Josh, you got an answer from seminary? Okay. All right. So, yeah, as these guys have said, the purpose of the body armor is to cover the vital organs, heart, lungs, other internal organs like kidneys. So if an enemy spear or a javelin, some kind of arrow, sharp, pointy objects, right, Jack? Things like that. Any of that comes in and pierces any of those vital organs, it's usually going to result in a mortal wound ending in death. Even if you did survive the blow, though, let's say you survived that blow, took out one lung, then you got another, it's still going to take you out of the fight. You're not going to feel like doing a whole lot of more battle after that. So it's definitely going to end your career. So soldiers, since the beginning of warfare, they have learned the value of wearing body armor into battle. No one wants to rush into a phalanx of enemy arrows and spears unprotected. You wind up dead that way, right? You need good body armor. Now, we understand the physical aspect of this, but I want to ask a different question. This is a different question, okay? So here's the question. What is the advantage of having that kind of protection? Before you say, to protect your vital areas, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a different question. Practically, immediately speaking, how did that affect the soldier wearing that body armor? How did it affect him on the battlefield? Joe and then Doug.
It takes away your fear of getting attacked there. You're not afraid.
Okay. Takes away your fear. You know, because when you run out there with just nothing but your shirt on and you got pointy objects coming at you, what does that do to your confidence? It erodes it, right? Nobody wants to do that. Doug?
That was my answer, too, is it increases your confidence.
Increases your confidence. Alyssa.
I don't know. Also, another thing it does is, like, thinking of David and Goliath, when he put on armor that he wasn't used to, he couldn't. It inhibited him. So if you're going to wear a breastplate, you need to practice with it. You need to practice with your armor. You can't just practice without it and then all of a sudden put it on and go out. You'll slow down. You'll be less accurate. You'll be less flexible. It'll be heavy, awkward. So you have to be used to wearing it.
That is a great, great comment. And we're going to come back to it. So think about that next week, too, because we're going to come back to that in some application, some thought about application about not wearing somebody else's armor, not walking around in Saul's armor, right? So good. That's an awesome comment, though. Was there another? Yeah, Nick?
So an example. The guy who introduced me to mountain biking, he got some like shin guards and stuff and elbow pads and things like that. And he would do a lot more daring things than I did. And he said it was because of that stuff he was wearing. I never tried it, but I always thought I'd probably take more jumps than I do now, you know, if I had that.
Yeah, so that's a real good practical illustration of the effect of wearing something that's going to protect your soft parts. You know, it increases your confidence, takes away your fear. It's exactly right. So in order for this to be effective, in order for body armor to give us that confidence, to take away that fear, to help us to rush into battle, we have to have confidence in the armor, right? No good putting, you know, like a little kid taking and putting cardboard around us and then rushing into battle. That's not going to give us any confidence. We're going to know exactly what that's about. Armor needs to be strong. And if possible, armor needs to be unable to be penetrated, impenetrable. It needs to be impenetrable. So if you don't care how heavy, or kind of like you were saying, Alyssa, if you don't care how heavy or cumbersome it is, so you could always encase yourself in some kind of an iron cylinder, put a top and a bottom on it, and roll yourself at the enemy, right? That would keep you protected, but it would also make you completely ineffective. You'd just be a cylinder lying on the battlefield and not really helping your buddies. So it'd be so heavy you couldn't move around freely. What's that? You wouldn't have any many moves. You couldn't use those really cool battlefield moves. So armor, it had to be strong. It had to be light and flexible as well. And an armor needed to be careful. If you make it too light, well, then armor is going to lose all of its strength. If you lose too much strength, you lose your customer, right? You lose too many customers. You close up the armor and you find a new line of work. So the best armor is going to be both strong and light. You can see how the qualities of strength and weight are related to one another, right? So the more you increase the strength of your armor, the heavier it became. The more you made it lighter, the weaker it was, the more vulnerable you'd be in battle. One other factor in building armor was cost. Okay, so armor that had that proportion of strength and lightweight, more costly. Lightweight, flexible, very expensive. So every soldier is trying to find that perfect combination of sufficient strength and an acceptable weight and flexibility and all of that. So strong, lightweight armor, but it's got to fit the budget as well. So what I'm going to do as we walk through this tonight, I'm going to group the different armor into four basic types, and I'm going to cover them in ascending levels of protection. Lowest level of protection, also the cheapest, we'll call it level one. This is leather armor. Men cured animal hides, and then they used the leather to create body armor, maybe laying leather upon leather, sewing it together, stitching two pieces of leather, wrapping it around the trunk of the body, fasten it in the middle to create some, like right up here, the shoulders, creating a leather doublet. They might stitch together strips of leather going down the front, fasten them with metal studs. They might create what's called a leather cuirass. The word cuirass refers to a single piece that covers the front and a single piece that covers the back, and then it's fastened together at the shoulders and the sides. It could be leather or metal, but it's the same style. That's what a cuirass is. So sometimes soldiers, they'd be able to get their hands on a, maybe in their, for their leather armor, they'd get their hands on a metal plate made of either iron or bronze or something like that. They'd cut that round or rectangular and then fasten it with straps to the front of their chest as like a pectoral plate. Obviously provided some strength that their leather didn't provide. So provided that same protection to the heart, the most vital organ, but also even though they had that there, it would leave the rest of the thorax pretty exposed, vulnerable. So obviously leather armor offered the lowest level of protection, but it was cheap enough that a poorer soldier could find some access to that armor to afford it. Also, leather armor had the advantage of being relatively comfortable, pretty durable, didn't take a lot to maintain it, not much to it, just wash and wear. Throw it in the laundry and your wife can pull it out and hand it to you, say, go off to battle. Watch out for sharp objects. Now, you think that that's the armor that represents our breastplate of righteousness, or do you want to consider another level? You want to go up a level? All right, so I want to see what's behind door number two. Next level of protection, level two. Significantly higher than leather armor. It's chain mail armor. Jack, did you mention chain mail? Yeah, chain mail armor. Chain mail, at least in this day, first century and before, is constructed using 1 millimeter thick iron rings that were about 7 millimeters in diameter. So each iron ring was connected to four other iron rings by rivets or welds, and it created this interlocking chains of these little small rings. So this chainmail armor doubled at the shoulders, kind of like a tunic, and it hung down like a long shirt down to the hips or even further and provided a decent amount of protection over pretty large areas. It was essentially shapeless because it's just these little tiny rings, so it conformed to the body and was flexible, allowed the body to move and flex according to that body type and conform to the natural movements of that soldier. Now, even though this is like wearing a long shirt, remember that it's made out of thousands of small iron rings. That means it's pretty heavy, somewhere between 20 and 30 pounds to wear that. Keep the shoulders from bearing all the weight. The soldier would attach that armor to his belt, help distribute the weight, lighten the load. That chain mail would afford a decent amount of protection from incidental strikes or maybe poorly aimed strikes, something that's not a direct hit. But an enemy could pierce that chain mail armor with a very well-aimed thrust from a sword or a spear, or even like an aerial weapon at an effective range, like a javelin or an arrow that was loosed from maybe like a machine or something like that. So this is it was a pretty good price jump from leather armor to chainmail, but the protection it afforded, if you could afford that, was worth it to you. So like leather, is fairly durable, pretty easy to maintain and repair. If anything went wrong, you could just repair that small area. It wasn't too costly. Let me ask the question, does chainmail, does that represent our breastplate of righteousness, or do you see some insufficiencies there? You want to go up another level? I do too. Leather, chainmail, two more. Next level of protection, level 3 armor. We can call this level, I'm calling it level 3. It's found in scaled armor. So think of like fish scales or dragon scales, one covering over, and you've got the picture. It's the same principle. Scale armor is made using small iron or more often bronze plates. Small ones, just a few centimeters long, and the individual scales are wired together into rows of scales. The rows of scales then are sewn onto a fabric backing until row after row, going down that armor created, fabric backing created really a formidable set of like fish scales or dragon scales, okay? So the strength of scale armor, it came from that overlapping individual scales and then overlapping rows of scales. Had the effect of deflecting blows. The surface is like smooth and flexible, so that deflected blows, and then when they took contact, the scales would distribute the force of the blow, which significantly reduced the trauma to any particular area. So if you get hit here, the whole row and the whole plate receives and deflects all the energy of the blow, so you don't just feel it here like you would with chainmail or something like that. Scale armor, it's less flexible than chain mail and usually quite a bit heavier, up to 40 pounds. That's a lot of weight to carry when you're trying to move and run and dodge and thrust on a battlefield, a muddy battlefield, but it was much, much stronger. Plutarch wrote about a set of 35-pound scaled armor that could take a shot from a catapulted arrow at 20 paces and receive only a light scratch. Who wants to be that guy, you know? Just stand there. Just stay still. Now, just as a side note, Goliath's bronze scaled armor, just to put his size in perspective, usually it's like he's talking about 35 pounds, can go up to 40 pounds, that's big. Goliath, 125 pounds. That's a big dude. Big, big guy. That's why David aimed for his forehead. He's not getting through that scaled armor. This armor, the scaled armor, is very hard to maintain. Maintenance and repair is labor intensive. Those individual scales in due to the rigors of combat had a tendency to detach, so they required constant attention and repair. On the bright side, though, the constant attention to maintenance, always having, after every skirmish, every battle, having to take that back into the tent and give good attention to maintenance, that gave soldiers the opportunity not only to maintain and repair, but also the opportunity to polish the scales of their armor into a very bright, shiny, almost silvery finish. A lot of work, but it was, the effect was worth it. Because when they marched out together with rows and rows of scaled, polished armor, and enemy soldiers spotted rank upon rank of that polished armor, that was an impressive sight. All this, it really was a demonstration of battlefield presence. That high polish displayed the strength of the armor of the enemy that's coming at you, the wealth of the army, but also the care and the discipline of each individual soldier. When you're facing rank upon rank of strong, well-equipped, well-armored, and disciplined soldiers, that's pretty intimidating stuff. So you go from leather to chainmail, scale armor, and that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? One more, though, level four. This is plated armor. Plated armor. Plated armor is constructed from segments of iron plates. Some cut as plates and some cut like iron bands that may be wrapped around the shoulder and the torso. So the segments, they're connected together by leather straps underneath the armor, underneath the plates. And then the different sections are fastened together with buckles or hinges or hooks. And plated armor is really, really strong. It was actually lighter than chainmail, so it was around 20 pounds. Could be up to 20 pounds, and it provided excellent protection for shoulders, deflecting blows, stopping most strikes from arrows and spears and javelins and the rest. So, several drawbacks to segmented plate armor. Being made of iron plates and segments, it's somewhat inflexible and restrictive, especially compared to the chain mail and the scale armor. Sometimes it would constrict breathing, make that difficult. The complexity of the armor with its different kinds of metals that are used for different fasteners, the different metals meant different kind of maintenance problems. There would be chemical reactions between bronze fittings and iron plates, contributed to corrosion. That meant the fittings could fall off all the time. So the soldier did need to keep his armor well maintained. He needed to check it over frequently to maintain battle readiness. And like the scale armor, soldiers would also polish those segments until they gleamed in the sun. Segmented armor was obviously very expensive. The only kind of armor that was more expensive was a variation of plate armor called a full metal cuirass, or sometimes you refer to it as a muscled cuirass. A cuirass is, as I said, constructed from two single pieces of iron or bronze, polished to a high shine. Think in your mind of like a medieval knight, you know, with that armor, that polished to a shine. One piece covering the front, one covering the back, fastened together at the sides, very heavy and very expensive. There's also something called a muscled cuirass, and that muscled cuirass was cast to fit an individual soldier's torso, usually portrayed in the muscled, get the idea of the muscled idea, comes from portraying an idealized male physique. So large pectoral muscles, six-pack abs, perfect body shape, and all the rest. Deep navel, I guess that's important. But since it was a single piece of metal in the front, single piece in the back, it suffered fewer maintenance problems than segmented armor. But the same kind of regular care was provided since it had all those segmented strips of metal over the shoulders, still made use of fasteners. There's a writer named Adrian Goldsworthy, a very thorough book he wrote on the Roman army. He wrote something I found fascinating. I'll just read it to you here. He said, although various forms of muscled cuirass, most probably metal, are depicted as being worn by senior officers in Roman art, no example has survived from this period to confirm that this reflected actual practice and was not simple artistic convention. So you get what he's saying? Saying, I'm not even sure if these existed. I'm not even sure if these were used on the battlefield or if they're just portrayed in art as something that's idealized. So it casts some doubt on whether the muscled cuirass was actually used on the battlefield. A full metal cuirass, probably among the officers, but that highly detailed, stylized, exaggerated muscle cuirass, probably not. But the the if there was such a thing, it would probably be reserved for a hero's parade, some kind of maybe commemorative art or something like that, but it was just too pricey and impractical. But even the full metal cuirass, that was something that was extremely expensive as well. It was affordable only to those who were wealthy, so only generals, high-ranking officers could afford something that ornate, that well-built. Okay, so that's the observation. That's the different levels. Short survey of Roman body armor, leather, chain, scale, and plate. Wasn't that edifying? Let's have an altar call and everybody go home. Now, I'm going to give you just a little pop quiz. Make sure you're paying attention. This has a point, okay? So we got the microphones, and I do want hands raised. If you don't mind, don't just shout it out. But let's start with an easy one. Tell me which armor was the cheapest and which was the most expensive. Very easy one. Which was the cheapest, which was the most... Ryan?
Leather's the cheapest, plate's the most expensive.
Okay, good. Hey, all right. Thank you. Which one was the easiest to maintain and which was the hardest to maintain? Easiest and hardest to maintain. Doug?
The cheapest was the easiest to maintain, so the leather.
Okay.
The hardest to maintain was actually the scale.
Okay, good. You were listening carefully. Thanks, Doug. So let's get someone different. It is the scale armor. That's the level, I think I call it level 3. Why was the scale armor hardest to maintain? Gary?
A lot of moving pieces. An attachment.
Okay, a lot of moving pieces, a lot of detail to it, a lot of things attached to other things. So, Scott?
Layers.
Layers.
Didn't it have layers?
Okay, layers. Okay, so just layers of scales and stuff like that. Okay, good, yeah. Daniel wanted to answer too. And Arlen. Okay. Scott, to your right over there, Arlen.
Specifically, it was their individuals. So the chainmail, yeah, a lot of moving pieces as well, but they're all interlinked and have maybe a unity about them, but the scales were more independent.
Okay, all right, so more independent and interlinked and a lot of them, yeah. Good, Arlen?
Perhaps many more parts subject to vulnerability.
Okay, more parts means more complexity, more things subject to vulnerability, things falling apart. Also, just think about polishing all those individual scales. That takes a lot of time if you're going to do that. Which one was the most comfortable and which was the least comfortable? If comfort is your key, what's the most comfortable, what's the least comfortable?
The leather was the most comfortable because it was very maneuverable, and then the plates was the least comfortable.
The last one, right? The plates.
The last one.
Yeah.
Constricting.
Constrictive, yeah. Good. All right. So which of the metal armors do you think was the easiest to maintain and most comfortable to wear? Okay, chainmail. You didn't raise your hand. He's like, I know. I've been here a long time. I'm not feeling like it. Now, I don't want to do this just yet, but I asked all those questions because I want you to think of each of those questions in terms of righteousness. Okay? What righteousness is the cheapest and which is the most expensive? So if I just go back through these questions and ask them again, which righteousness is the easiest to maintain and which is the hardest? Why is the scale armor the hardest to maintain? And if we're talking about that in terms of righteousness, what kind of righteousness are we talking about? We'll come back to that. Which righteousness is the most comfortable? And which is the least comfortable? Which of the metal armors is the easiest to maintain, most comfortable to wear? What kind of righteousness is easy to maintain and comfortable to wear? And at the same time, it gives you the sense of, I'm protected. So just think about that. It highlights some of the differences between the armors, gives you the advantages, the disadvantages. Military men chose between these different armors. They considered their body style, their weight. They considered the fighting environment. They considered the level of their own battlefield skill and experience. Even a very good soldier who's very experienced may, depending on the mission, may choose leather armor over scaled armor or plated armor. He may say, I want to run onto this mission. Why? Because he wants to be quiet. It's a stealth mission. It's some kind of a hit behind the lines kind of a deal. He wants movement, maximum flexibility. He takes the risks. Other times, when it's a front-on battle facing a phalanx of enemy arrows and such, you want to be full-on covered, okay? Now, if cost were not a factor, what kind of armor would you choose and why? If cost is no factor to you, what kind of armor are you going to choose and why? Gary Brotherton. He was doing a few.
See, I would take on the scales because there's a little bit of a flexibility there. You can still move around in it, give me good protection. I can also make it nice and shiny and intimidate people. So.
All right. I appreciate that. Gives you a little flexibility, and he kind of digs the shine. You can just imagine Gary, who made this pulpit, by the way. I was just thanking him tonight for this pulpit. I'm so grateful for this. It's a desk. The Puritans used to call it the sacred desk. And I think that's exactly right. You can lay all your stuff on. I can even put my water bottle underneath it. Thank you, Gary. But he's a very detailed carpenter and a very detailed thinker. And so Gary likes the scaled armor. He wants to look like a dragon flowing on the battlefield with his scaled armor, breathing that fire and destruction. I like it. Christy.
Well, the fear of man struggle that I have, I would say the plate is what I would want to wear. However, what you just said about the wisdom of what type fits what circumstance best, there would be different seasons or different times where different armor would be better. So
okay.
I would want the best for the particular battle that I was facing.
Okay. All right. So when it comes to warfare, Christy, we all got a fear of man. It's not just man, but it's those sharp objects they hold in their hands. So we're with you. No problem. Yeah, Ryan.
So I would take the plate armor. The main drawback is breathing.
Needs that?
Yeah. So, but it affords maximum protection. It's still light enough to stay in the battle for longer. So you can maintain your strength while you're dealing damage.
Yeah, and I just want to say that it's not so constrictive that you can't run around and breathe. It's just uncomfortable. You know, that's the idea there. Yeah, thank you. Oh, two for one right here. Go ahead.
I would choose the scale-like because it's the heaviest and it takes a lot of detail. So if I train with that, I can switch to any of the others easier because I'm used to the weight and I'm used to having to maintain and detailed. So if I train with the one, then I can use it in battle or I can switch to another one and it's really easy.
All right, always thinking ahead. Good. All right, so she's thinking about the future, getting herself strong for any kind of armor. Chuck, you were going to say? And then we have one over here? Yeah, let's start with Ron first.
I would choose the leather.
Okay.
The reason being is it's flexible, and you can dart, dodge, and move pretty quick, and you can react much quicker than you could with the metal on.
Okay. So you like the flexibility and the ability to move and dodge and dart. You like a righteousness that basically suits you and conforms to any situation you like. Is that what you're saying?
No, but what I like is I'll clear that up. No, but what it does is it gives you protection to a limit, but it also gives you the mobility to react to a blow coming at you.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ron. Yeah, I understand that. I really do. I don't like when I had to wear body armor. I did not like it. I like the flexibility and the movement. Yes, Chuck, you handed the mic back.
It was more in jest. So.
Okay, all right. It wasn't that good.
He wants Frodo's mithril.
Yeah, well, that's not part of the, that's fantasy. That's not part of the reality in history. Yeah, Josh.
Yeah, I would, because I'm weak, would want the light-plated armor, and because I'm not experienced in battle, would also like the strongest armor. And if the, I mean, Ron's got the leather jacket guy. If I looked at, I can see why you look good in the leather there, but I would want the for my inexperience and the leather armor, like Ron said, you have to trust in your ability more, and I can't do that.
Okay. That's actually, that little contrast there is an insightful contrast. If you think about that in terms of righteousness, important. Yeah, John?
I would choose the scale armor simply because it gives you the maximum protection, and we're told that the arrows are fiery arrows, so that you'd want to be able to deflect that as well. And also, you never know where the attack will come from. It could be
coming from the side. So an oblique attack.
From the side, it may pop up right in front of you, or it may be a long distance away.
Right. And just to be clear, both plated and scaled offer that maximum coverage. Okay? So arrows can come from down below. They can come straight at you and come from the side. Yeah, good. So you want maximum coverage, 360, top, bottom. That's what you're looking for. That's important to you. Good. All right. Well, last question. What kind of armor do you think Paul wants us to picture in Ephesians 6:14, and why? And Christy, you were saying, I want all kinds, and I want to use them all for different purposes, and I introduced that thought, you know, but I'm rescinding that. You have one choice and one choice only of what Paul is picturing here. What do you think? What did Paul want us to, Bruce, what did Paul want us to picture, and why?
The righteousness imputed to us by Christ.
Okay. No. No. So let me just make it clear. The righteousness imputed by Christ is that which is the basis of our justification. Okay? So as far as sanctification, this is something we're putting on. This is something that we have to wear. So of those four, what do you think Paul is wanting us to picture? No, you got the mic. All right. Fair enough. Go right behind a rod there. We got one on this side? Okay. Rod?
I think, you know, he's telling us to put on the full armor of God.
Okay.
So the full armor would be for the maximum protection. It's not something, again, it's something we put on.
Okay.
It's not of us. It's the armor that's protecting us. So he's asking us to put on the full armor. So it would be the maximum protection we could have.
Okay, all right, so maximum protection. So that which gives you the maximum protection. So you're thinking more in terms of scaled or plated, something like that. All right. We have a Hepner. We have somebody who says no. Okay. Jake? What do you think Paul is wanting us to picture here?
I believe Paul wants us to picture ourselves in the muscled cuirass that we see on the Roman legionaries, the heroes of war.
Oh, all right. He's just gone up another level. And but wait, he's not done. Why?
Because in the end, the muscled cuirass gives the most protection, with still a fair amount of ability to really maneuver yourself into where you need to be. And in the end, it is the
looks
cool. Is reserved.
It looks cool.
It is the armor that is reserved, as we see in art, for the heroes, the most important and the strongest of the warriors.
All right. I kind of like that answer, too. The coolest, the most heroic. All right?
So I was looking at Philippians 1:11. It says that Paul wants us to be filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Christ. And so I think of the scaled armor, that the fruits are, there's many fruits that we possess. So it's all those pieces of scaled armor that we possess through the righteousness of Christ. And so that scaled armor, we're able to have, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, gentleness, self-control, all those things working together, you know, and they're fruits of that protection that we have through the breastplate.
All right, that's a really good answer too. So it's like the manifold glory of those, well, fruits. You don't want fruits hanging off you, but you have like all the different shines and how the light catches it and shines in different in various ways. Yeah, that's good. I like that answer. That's really good. We don't, okay. Any more? Oh, run back there.
So I tend to think the fourth one, first of all, because it says the breastplate of righteousness, which, you know, leather, chain, and scales are not really breastplates. I also think that Christians are called more than anything else to take a defensive position, like when you were talking about standing firm. We're holding the truth that, you know, belongs to Christ. We're not necessarily taking, we're not out to attack Satan.
We're not going on special missions.
Right.
All right.
And then also, it's the breastplate of righteousness. And righteousness is not easy or cheap, like the, you know, the other armors. And then also with the lightness metaphor, you were talking about scale armor being heavier. There is a lightness that we can have, kind of that confidence that we can have in the fourth armor.
All right. What an interesting answer. Thank you. That was good. I appreciate that. Okay. Nicholas and Daniel. And that'll, let's, unless there's a burning, okay, we'll end with Daniel.
I was just going to ask, is this the word for, like, at the actual, like, when it says breastplate, I'm thinking the plated. Is that the same, is it the Greek, does the Greek say that too? Or is it this kind of our English rendering of, is the Greek word a more general one is what I'm asking?
Yeah, it's a more general, it could refer to all these different types.
I'm inclined to think that it would be any of them, because all Christians are not the same. Some are rich, some are poor, some have this gift, some have that gift. So I'm tempted to believe that, you know, whatever the fight is, you know, if you need to be stealthy or if you need to do this, you know, different Christians have different gifts as the body comes together with those gifts to serve one another. So the cavalry has their position, the javelins have theirs, or, you know, cannons have their gifts. So
okay. So you would think that when it says the breastplate of righteousness, asterisk, depends on where you serve, what kind it is. Yeah, okay, all right. Well, okay. I said Daniel was the last one. You're like, but I'm holding the mic. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, well, two things. I kind of agree with Daniel.
Kind of,
yeah.
But you're hedging
no,
on that.
I do, yeah. That was a very good comment. and then number two is, I was going to, like, back off of what Jake was talking about, because what was that called again, the armor?
The muscled cuirass?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, okay.
You can't agree with both of them. They're mutually exclusive.
No, I was just, anyway, what I'm going to say is that, so the, it seems what he was saying is that there's been a lot of victories in mm-hmm. the past with that armor. And if you think about it, like that means that with that armor, they've had the most victory, which means they've withstood a lot of battles, you know. And if you take it to biblical terms, they've withstood a lot of temptation.
Okay. And all right. Good. So. Good answer. A lot of good answers tonight. It really, and all the different comments, you're looking at this from different angles, and that, you know, so you're not wrong in what you're saying. We're gonna We're going to come back, though, as we start to interpret and apply next time, and we're going to think this through as it applies to righteousness, as it applies to righteousness being a protective covering over mortal, and note this, career-ending sins. You know, I see sometimes pastors committing career-ending sins. So this, for me personally, as a pastor, this kind of stuff stands out to me big time to maintain and to be concerned about that. So we did some observation work this evening, and next week, as I said, we'll do some interpretation work and application work. We'll talk about the spiritual parallels here, hopefully get into the application. So just keep in mind, in spiritual warfare, and this is Bruce's comment right here. This is kind of where he was going. Our armor is not made from leather or chainmail or metal scales or metal plates. Our armor, the metal of our armor, is righteousness. And in what Bruce said, it's the righteousness of Jesus Christ. He's talking about it in terms of imputation, which has been imputed to us. That's talking about positionally. This is also, as the Puritans used to talk about, the metal of, or the righteousness of impartation. This is where we're being imparted, a righteousness of God. It's a righteousness of Christ, and it's something that we're growing in. Christ is himself covered in righteousness. And so it's that righteousness that we seek to be covered with also. Listen to this in Psalm 37, 3-6. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. If you trust in anything else to protect you, or when you neglect to examine and maintain your righteousness, the devil is satisfied with that. He's happy with that. You're not a threat to him. When you don't neglect the breastplate of righteousness, but when you examine it regularly, when you maintain it carefully, when you polish it faithfully, when you keep it on yourself at all times, that is to say, in just simple terms, when you live a holy life, when you pursue holiness, you completely thwart Satan with a righteousness that shines like the noonday sun. And you're going to glorify the God who gave you that armor in the first place.